Today's presenters are Randy Miller and Prasad Amandi. Randy Miller is a member of the Level 2 Technical Support Team for WebSphere Message Broker. Randy's primary focus is supporting WebSphere Message Broker on the ZOS platform. He also supports WebSphere Message Broker on the distributed platforms. Prasad is a member of the Level 2 Technical Support Team for WebSphere Message Broker. Prasad has been working with the Message Broker product since the first broker release, MQSI. He works primarily on distributed platforms. Randy and Prasad work with customers worldwide in diagnosing and resolving WebSphere Message Broker problems. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Randy and Prasad.
Okay, welcome everyone. My name is Randy Miller. I'm with Prasad Amandi here. We're members of a Level 2 support team for the WebSphere Message Broker located in Raleigh, North Carolina. For the next 40 minutes or so, we're going to cover common problems with the message broker and how to resolve or avoid them. So I'd like to ask you now to flip over to the third coil, please. Okay, the focus of this presentation will be primarily on the version 6 broker, although many of the items that we're going to cover would also apply to version 5 as well. We will be covering those problems that customers run into time and time again, as well as some issues that have only been reported very recently. Okay, that said, the agenda for this particular presentation, we've taken common problems and broken that up into three groups, if you will. Security, configuration, and runtime. And then towards the end of the presentation, we'll also cover some noteworthy APARs as well as provide some bookmarks for your reference. So at this point, I'd like to turn over to Prasad to get us started here.
Thanks, Randy. Good morning. My name is Prasad Amandi, and next foil, please. We're on page 4 for those of you who are looking at a printout of this presentation. I'd like to start off by giving a quick, in a nutshell, view of the product. This is a foil that has been around for a while, and it's quite possible that most of you have seen this before, but from an introductory point of view, and also for those of you who are coming to the broker product who have started working recently, we just decided it might be a good idea to look at the complete picture of the broker product. WebSphere Message Broker is a multi-component product, and this picture is supposed to capture all the components. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. The three basic components, the broker runtime and an administrative component called the configuration manager, which manages a single or a multiple number of brokers within a single broker domain. And then there is a tooling interface for developers and administrators to develop the message flows or the message modeling and for administrators to manage the broker environment. And the tooling pretty much is an Eclipse-based toolkit. And most times the interaction with the broker product would be through the tooling where you, if you're a developer, you develop your message flows or your messages, message sets. And that get deployed over to the broker through what's known as a bar file. It's pretty much a packaging concept where you bundle your message flows and message sets, and the bar file gets deployed, and the configuration manager picks up this bar file and forwards it to the respective broker that you are deploying to. The broker itself is the runtime broker, yet again, is a multi-process component. What I mean by that is it has multiple processes from an operating system point of view. The actual message flows run as threads within a process called a data flow engine, whose logical view is known as execution group. It's more a structuring your environment, per se, so you have a better control in terms of how you deploy your message flows and how you structure your broker. And each message flow, as I said, runs as a thread and picks up messages from an input, depending on whatever transport you are using. Could be web services, could be MQ transport, could be file transport if you're using file extender, and there are multiple transports that are supported. And to pretty much wrap up on this file, the broker used the database for its repository, mainly for restart recovery. And with that said, that's supposed to be a quick in a nutshell overview, mainly to show you the different components within the product. Next file, please. Moving on to page 5, one of the common problems that we see very frequently, I don't want to say on a daily basis, but very, very frequently, definitely a few times a week, is security issues. And when we look at security issues, we really look at the interaction going on between the three components. And this file is supposed to, it's meant to capture the three components and the underlying communication, and more or less to show you that the broker uses MQ, WebSphere MQ, as a prereq, and all communication is through messaging layer. The toolkit actually is a Java client, Java MQ client, sends a request message, could be a deploy message, to the configuration manager, which through SKU manager, forwards it to the respective broker you're deploying to. The broker processes the message and sends it back to, sends a response back to the originator, which is configuration manager, which in turn sends back to the toolkit. Now, when we look at this communication, it's important. Let's move on to the next slide, please. It's important to understand that there should be sufficient authorizations for the users working with the broker product at an MQ level. What this means is the users, or in this case the developers, must have access to the configuration manager, queue manager, and the queues to which they need to send messages to and get responses back from. So this is pretty much to show you, we're on page 6, it's to show you the error that you might get in case you have a problem with MQ series configuration. It's 2035, that's their return code, matched to a user not authorized. And this is to show you the internal queues to which the access needs to be granted. Typically, broker is pretty good with externalizing the underlying return codes from the prereq products, either the WebSphere MQ or database. And usually, if you see a message like this, there will be a corresponding object which is throwing this message, so it should be pretty simple, pretty easy for you to look at the logs and try to see which object it's failing on to access. Now, do keep in mind, since the underlying transport communication is through MQ series, channels are pretty much at work here, and once you have MQ series channels sending messages back and forth, it's important to make sure you have the MCA user, which is the property on the channel that defines which user is sending messages. So it's important for you to check that the MCA user is either set if you're required to set it in your environment, or if you, depending on how you have your MQ security configured, you may not need to set MCA user property. Let's move on to the next file. With the recent versions of Broker, I think we started with version 5, we introduced access control list, and Randy is going to talk specifically about the issues we've seen with access control list with Message Broker.
Okay, thanks. The next couple of foils deal with ACLs, or access control list, and basically that gives the ability to manage functionality or rather capability from a user point of view as far as what they can and can't do on the message broker. And the very first one I'm going to talk about here is more of a limitation than it is actually a problem, and it deals primarily with defining group ACLs, okay, and particularly with version 6, we announced the capability to move Configuration Manager off of Windows and onto Unix and ZOS. In doing so, what we end up doing is you sort of get to a point where you have messages from a Windows environment flowing into a non-Windows environment. So you get into the situation where you have domain IDs coming in and being checked or verified on platforms that don't support Windows domains. The very first issue that we run into that we talk to customers about is if you specify a group ACL and you define certain IDs to be within that group, when a message is coming in from the toolkit that has domain information, that domain information is ignored. So there is no concept of doing any kind of domain checking when you have group ACLs defined. The box in the middle just sort of shows an ACL entry that would be created for a particular config manager, and in this particular case, if an ID or a message came in with, that had AIM domain with an ID of JDoe, and we had to go to this particular group to check it, we would only check that JDoe was there, not that the domain level user ID was there. So this is indicating that if you choose to use group ACLs, then just be aware that domain information is not performed as part of that check. APAR IY91795, which is actually picked up in 6-pack 4, corrects an issue that we had where we had mixed case IDs being checked against Unix IDs within a group. And of course, those would be lowercase, so we would have a mismatch there. With this particular APAR, we'll do a lowercase compared to the IDs in that group. Okay, next one, please. Okay, if you need to set an ACL or perform checking at a domain user ID level, then what you would want to do would be to actually create an ACL for a user and not actually put them in a group. When you do it as a user, you can specify a domain name, and what we're showing here in the box in the middle is where we're listing an ACL entry, and it actually shows that we've got an ACL for AIM domain / JDoe. So if your requirement is to be able to check for IDs coming in that they're from a particular domain, then you would want to actually set those as a user level ACL and not a group. And then, of course, you would want to also make sure that that ID that's coming in has MQ authorization for any access to MQ resources. Next foil, please.
We're going to switch gears here a bit. We've just covered security, and we're going to now move over to configuration issues that we see with the message broker. First one we're going to talk a little bit about has to do with the broker registry, and just to cover that real briefly, the broker registry is a set of information that each broker has that has particular configuration information in it, and it's used as part of the broker startup. Okay, it gets created at the time the broker is either installed or created depending upon the platform that we're talking about here. And the type of information that's contained within the registry are things like the database name that the broker is going to be using, any type of little path directory information that needs to be loaded, obviously configuration, timeout, and delay timeouts, HTTP port numbers, queue manager names, things like that. The location of these are a little bit different depending upon where the broker is installed. On Windows, it's maintained within a Windows directory. On Unix and ZOS, it's actually part of the file system off of the work path variable, registry / broker name current version is where you would actually find that. So given all that, we'll go ahead to the next foil and we'll actually discuss the issue that we see. Okay, the issue that we see relative to the registry is that customers, once they discover that it's there and the kind of information that it contains, will actually go into some of these files and make modifications. And what we find is that most editors will append whitespace characters to the end of the string within these files. And the broker is particularly sensitive to this and will oftentimes fail in manners that aren't necessarily predictable. And not always at the time that you make the change. So you may set a change, and then you may not actually see the result of it until you stop and then restart the broker. So it's always recommended that, unless directed by us, that you use the commands or jobs provided with the product to interact with these particular sets of configuration data. And then we just give a couple examples here of the MQSI change broker command that you would use on Windows, Unix, or on ZOS on version 6, you would actually use the BIPCHBK job, which internally has the change broker command in it, or you could even issue an MVS modify command to do the same thing. So at this point, I think I'd like to turn it back over to Prasad, and he'll talk a bit more about configuration issues.
Thanks, Randy. Given the time, the limited time we have, we wanted to focus on some of the most used functionality of the broker. So let's talk a little bit about broker and web services support through HTTP nodes. This is a functionality that we've noticed is being extensively used, and so we figured we'd share a couple of problems that we commonly see with this in this area. More specifically, HTTP nodes and SSL is a functionality which gets used in situations where you're calling a secure web service. And it requires a bit of a configuration. You'll need to import the certificate, the SSL certificate for the web service within the broker's trust store. And the broker provides this functionality using the underlying Java security that is provided within the JRE, and the trust store that it uses to store by default is called the Caserets file, and this file is within the broker's JRE lib security, and it's within the broker install directory /JRE lib/security, and most usually, if you haven't changed the location of this file, and if you're going with the default configuration, then you will be using this file to store your certificates. The problem here, which we found out, is during fixed pack installs, this location gets overwritten, and by doing so, there's a potential that you're going to lose your Caserets file. Which means whenever after every fixed pack install, you may have to redo much of the effort you did by re-importing the certificates. And this is something that is being looked into and will be addressed in a future fixed pack. But there is a workaround for this, or a couple of workarounds for this, I guess. The easy thing to do would be to back up your Caserets file. That way you can save quite a bit of effort and time. If you install a fixed pack, you just have to replace the Caserets file without having to go through an entire importing all the certificates. The other workaround which you might want to look at is changing the location of the file itself from the default Caserets. You can actually provide an environment variable, provide a file name to be used as a trust store on an environment variable, and it's called, the environment variable is called IBM_Java_options. This is a Java environment variable pretty much used to pass information to the underlying broker's JRE. And we're on page 12, and which shows you a sample of how you set this environment variable. It's pretty simple. Set the environment variable IBM_Java_options equals -d, and I'm not going to read the entire information since it's provided for you on this page, and you can look at it. The key point to note is there's no spaces anywhere within this environment variable, so please be aware of that. You should not have any spaces after or before the equal sign, and also after the dash D and the Java X. I mean, it should be typed in exactly as it is shown here. If you were to include a space, that will cause a problem. The JRE might not pick up the environment variable correctly. Further also, the environment variable itself is slightly different depending on the platform that you're running. And if it is HP and Solaris, it is _Java_options, and you don't have the IBM prefix to that. You can set this environment variable within the broker startup environment, which typically, if it's version 6, you can go ahead and set it within the NQSI profile or on ZOS. It's the ENV file, right?
That's
yeah.
Exactly right. Yep.
On ZOS, you can set it in the ENV file, so you don't have to worry about setting it every time you start the broker. And of course, since it has to be picked up by the broker, it requires the broker restart to get affected. Let's move on to the next file, page 13, please, and talk a little more about HTTP known issues. This is very specific to Unix, where we've come across a few users who are trying to use change the default port number for HTTP and HTTPS, which by default the broker uses 7080 and 7083, I believe, and for customization according to their enterprise, they were trying to use a port number that's less than 1024, and it wasn't working. The problem was the HTTP listener was failing to start the minute they changed the port numbers to anything less than 1024, which means, yeah, your broker is going to work. Your message flows are going to run fine. However, the listener, HTTP listener process will fail to start. As a result, you will not be able to run any message flows with HTTP nodes, since the HTTP functionality will be disabled. The problem here is on Unixes, all ports below 1024 are privileged ports that are used, that are designated for the operating system, and only root has access to these ports. Yes, we understand that depending on your organization's requirements, you might want to tweak the ports, the default ports, but if you want to change them to something less than 1024, be aware of this problem, because only root has access to the ports, which means you must create the broker with root as a service ID. And subsequently, of course, once you use root as a service ID, you must ensure that the root has necessary privileges for the underlying prereq systems, which is MQ in the database. Moving on to the next common problem that we see, as I said a little while ago, we were trying to focus on some of the most common functionality that's being used within the broker developer community. Java Compute Nodes is an excellent primitive that is being used extensively, and of course the broker has an excellent debugger that it provides to debug your message flows. And it is possible to debug Java Compute Nodes as well and the Java code within your Java Compute Node. The way you do that is by configuring a JVM debug port, so the Java code can be instrumented within the JVM. And the command, we're on page 14, by the way, the command NQSI change properties that I've provided here shows you how you can configure to provide a JVM debug port. And the problem we have seen a few times is if you look at the command, the dash E execution group name is an option that needs to be provided, wherein each execution group, given that each execution group is it maps onto a physical process called data flow engine, the port number is unique to each execution group, which means you must not share the same port number between different execution groups or between different data flow engine processes. And if you do, then you could see you could see bizarre behavior depending on the platform. On Windows, I believe we've seen different debug sessions getting confused and data getting transposed, which is definitely not a good thing, as it will cause quite a bit of confusion. The other issue here is, while you can definitely make sure that you're not sharing a port number between execution groups, the command itself, NQSI change properties, presently it doesn't enforce a mandatory restriction that the dash E execution group must be present on NQSI change properties. And as a result, there is a possibility that by oversight you could enter a command without this flag, without the execution group name. And when you do that, the broker actually, the command causes all execution groups to be set to use the same port number, which is an absolute no-no, as we just discussed a little while ago, because that would cause problems. That would cause problems as severe as on Unixes. It'll cause your broker to fail to start. We will move on to the next fault here, page 15. The error would be processes, more specifically data flow engine processes, will try to start and will try to bind the port and will fail because the port would be in use. So could lead to a very fatal problem in terms of bringing down the environment. And so it's important for you to be aware that the dash E flag on NQSI change properties is a mandatory flag. And this is actually being addressed as we speak, and we're going to make it a mandatory flag just so users don't enter into this pitfall. Right, but what happens if you do? If you do by oversight enter this command right now, as I said, it's possible that your broker will fail to start, and to recover will require a manual intervention because JVM debug code is stored within the broker database. While I could have given you the actual manual recovery procedure here, since we prefer that you don't manually intervene with the broker database, I'd rather just advise you that you call us so we can walk you through the procedure and get your broker environment back up and running. It's pretty much a database statement that goes and tweaks a specific row in a specific table. So the port numbers can be reset back to zero and the broker will start for you successfully. So it's kind of important that you use the dash E flag on the NQSI change properties command when you are configuring for JVM debug code. Moving on to the next file, which is, we're kind of moving on to the toolkit now, which is, of course, a very commonly used component on a day-in, day-out basis. And for those of you who are active developers who would like to constantly update your bar files, and then otherwise for awareness, in case you notice that your bar file generation or the toolkit itself is getting slow as and when you increase the usage, there is a known issue in this area with respect to how the bar file is getting built. If you ever notice, when you open a bar file, you'll have four tabs at the bottom. There's a content, which shows your compile message flow files. There's a configure, which shows your promoted properties. And then there's a user and a service log, which are meant for service teams to look at if there's a problem. The problem here is that the service log is getting accumulated over a period of time with every refresh. It's not getting replaced, but it's getting appended. And so this is causing the size of the bar file to grow with usage, resulting in a slow functioning of the toolkit over a period of time. While this is addressed in Fixpack 5, we want to increase the awareness within the community because we've seen quite a few people move to Fixpack 5, but still there's a large amount of message broker users that are running previous Fixpack levels. So if you're one of those that are running previous Fixpack levels, just be aware that there is a toolkit performance issue with increased usage. And there's a quick fix for this, actually. While the code fix is included in Fixpack 5, if you are not there yet where you can move to Fixpack 5, you can actually go remove the service log manually, open the bar file, and click that little red the button that's circled in this file, which pretty much is remove service log file, and that's going to clean up the file for you, and you can get back to be in good shape in using the toolkit. Moving on to the next part of common problems, as Randy was saying initially, we took quite a bit of time trying to trying to come up with and structure this properly, since the extensive functionality of the broker, we were not sure which areas to focus, so we decided to do security, configuration, runtime. So we talked about security, we talked about configuration. Let's now look at a few runtime issues that we've seen, and I'll turn over to Randy to start on that.
Okay, thank you. This particular issue is specific to ZOS, and it would surface if you were attempting to deploy a message flow to the ZOS broker that would contain any JMS nodes. If you were to do that, the first symptom that you would see would actually be the MQ return code of 2019 associated with one of the system broker execution group, either the reply or the execution group queue. Because the execution group is no longer able to use its queues, you would find the execution group was unresponsive to any types of commands, list commands or such. This particular issue is currently under investigation. There's actually three separate APARs to deal with this particular issue, one in MQ, one in its JMS, and one in the broker. The broker APAR is PK54892. I suspect that we should have some more information on this within a week or two. As soon as that information becomes available, we'll certainly publish a tech note. So our advice to you would be to first get on our website and do a search for that. And then if you're unable to locate that, just give us a call and we can assist you further. So I'm going to go ahead and pass it back to Prasad to continue up with an additional JMS issue.
Thanks, Randy. I just want to mention that for those of you who are looking at the presentation online or the printouts, please be aware that the APAR that is included in the presentation is PK47865, while the broker APAR here is PK54892, in case you want to track it. And if you have any questions on this, please feel free and let us know after towards the end of this session when we open up for questions and answers. Moving on to the next foil, to continue talking about JMS now, something we just uncovered with FixPack 5 is if you're using JMS now, then there's a problem with the way exception list is getting populated. The exception list tree is being incomplete, and it is again specific to FixPack 5. We've decided to talk about problems at different FixPack levels, just because we understand that some of you might be at FixPack 5, some of you might be at earlier releases. So we thought it would give you a good complete picture of current issues we're having. FixPack 5, if you have any message flows with JMS nodes, please be aware that if you have a parser exception or a user exception using a throw node, you'll find that the exception list is incomplete and missing this parser and user exception folders. And what this means really is you will not be able to handle these exceptions if you're coded for the handling of these exceptions within a catch terminal or a fail terminal. This is being looked at as we speak. Mindy is currently under investigation, and we expect to come out with an iFix pretty soon on this. So just be aware that when you go up to FixPack 5, you will not be able to handle user and parser exceptions within a catch or fail terminal. Moving on to the next foil, Randy is going to talk a little bit about tracing, which's been a functionality that we use on a day-in-day-out basis, given that we work in the support team here. And the problem really has been that while we request users to enable tracing, we've seen quite a few situations where traces are not disabled and they cause problems. I'll turn over to Randy so he can tell us a little bit about tracing and how you can find out if traces are running or not.
Okay. With tracing, it always seems that it's an issue that we sort of trace back to. Either customers will report that performance is a little bit slower than they're expecting, or that they have startup issues or something like that. And as we investigate the issue, at times we actually get back to the fact that tracing had been left on or is on, has had a chance to fill up the HFS, or is just using a lot of cycles when they're wanting to do additional testing or whatever. But I'll just go through these kind of quickly. We have the commands here for turning trace on and off. It's obviously recommended anytime you're not actively debugging a flow, looking at the message as it goes node to node, that you would turn tracing off, or if you're using trace nodes, that you would set the destination to none. The thing to remember, though, is that trace parameters are persistent, so if you turn it on, it's going to stay on until you turn it off, all right, which could be several days or weeks later. And then we have the MQSI report trace command there that you can use to check for a particular flow actually being traced, but we'll talk a little bit more of that in just a bit. Next foil, please. Okay. What we find out generally is that the problem that's associated with this particular the foils here really has to do with trying to figure out what flow is tracing. All right. Once we discover that trace has been left on, and let's say this is an environment where you've got a broker with several execution groups and a lot of flows, to try to figure out exactly what the component is that's causing trace data to be written. Okay, and the thing that you can do is actually look at the actual location where the trace data is kept, and that's going to be in the basically the broker work path /common/log, and there you'll find a number of sets of trace binary files. If you check them, if you did sort of a repetitive list on that, you would see. Some files would probably be growing. If that's the case, then you've got trace active. And by using the file name, you can actually determine what component is running and be able to then turn it off and resolve that issue. So the next foil, we'll go ahead and do that quick little example. Here's a couple of file names. And from this, we can glean the broker name. Then there's this hexadecimal string of data that represents the execution group UUID. That UUID, if you were to go to one of the either the application event log in Windows or a syslog or job log in ZOS, you'd be able to determine which execution group the label of this particular UUID. And then the third piece of information is the trace type, and it's either going to be trace or user trace. If you've put a call into service and we asked you to take a trace, we'll generally ask you for a service trace, since there's quite a bit more information in there. That would be the file name that has .trace on the end, whereas if you were doing your own debugging, you may have used the actual user trace option, and so you would have files that had data in them that contain that information. So with these three pieces of information, you can actually get pretty close to understanding the issue or the flow that's contributing to the issue here. So just go to the next foil, please. This is foil 22. But now that we have the component ID and the execution group label and the trace type, if you plug those three pieces of information into and run the MQSI read log, MQSI format log, and then look within the formatted trace output, you would actually be able to see the flow label being used in there. And then with that fourth piece of information, you could then go ahead and use the MQSI change trace to turn those off, and then that should be the issue. And you may discover that you've got multiple flows that are out there tracing. If you're not careful and over time you've turned several on and just forgotten to turn them off. It's very easy once you have something that's fixed, just to sort of move on quickly without doing the proper cleanup. So the next foil, the last foil pertaining to this particular issue, a good practice is to always delete all of the files in that log directory before starting up the broker. That way, after the broker has come up and run for five or ten minutes or so, you can look in there, and if you see any files that have any significant size to them, then that would be a pretty good indication that you've got trace active writing trace files to those files. Tracing is performance intensive, and obviously, you know, the more tracing that you're doing, the less resources you have available to your message flow for processing of messages. So that kind of talks to the tracing issue. It's one that we see really more regularly than what you'd expect. So given that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it back to Prasad now, and he'll continue on with some additional runtime issues.
Thanks, Randy. To continue the on the subject of tracing, tracing involves a configuration change. What it really means is that when you start or stop a tracing, it actually sends a message over to the broker or the execution group. The command actually sends a message to the execution group or broker so the database can be updated, and that's exactly what I meant by configuration change. Now, with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about shared variables. A shared variable is pretty much a variable that you can set it to, usually it is set to a constant, and it is reused within a message flow or multiple threads of the flow. Shared variables get reset. Shared variables get reset through a configuration change, and that's the information I really wanted to talk about here, because when you either provide a start and stop of trace, when you provide a command, when you run a command to start and stop of a trace, or not only trace, accounting and statistics commands, MQSI, change flow stats, command. They involve a configuration change. What that means is the shared variable gets reset whenever there's a configuration change. It's important for you to the developers to know that because if you have a message flow with a logic where every message does an update to a shared variable, you'll quickly find out after running a trace or after running a command to enable or disable change flow stats, the shared variable value will get reset, and it's no longer going to hold the value that's expected for the next message, but it's going to get reset to the original value, however you initialized it. The best practice when you're using shared variables is always to ensure that you initialize them, and I've provided a snippet in the notes page for you to use, or generally to give you an idea of how you can use shared variables. You always want to check for its existence before you use a shared variable, and if it doesn't exist, you may want to reinitialize it. And that way, you're not caught by surprise when it gets reset and by running a trace command or a change flow command. And also that way you're always absolutely sure that the shared variable is initialized and is available for usage within your flow for the next message. Moving on to the next runtime problems, one of the areas that we continue to see issues within the message broker user community is the key functionality that is done on a day-in, day-out basis, which is deploys, and which is a subject that we're going to talk about a little bit, because this is a subject that we talk about pretty much whenever we get an opportunity to talk to the broker community, because deploys is a key functionality, and we want to make sure that every time you deploy, you want to get a successful deploy. And I'm going to pass on to Randy to talk a little bit about deploys.
Okay. the next subject is going to talk about another runtime issue, and it's kind of an odd issue that we see every several months or so, and we've kind of gotten pretty good at recognizing the behavior, though it tends to catch customers by surprise. And what we discover is that they'll generally see this particular issue or behavior several times before they even report it because they don't quite understand what happened. And the scenario kind of goes that upon startup, the broker comes up, but then it just doesn't do anything. There are no errors reported. As you would then go ahead and begin to try to figure out what was gone, you'd probably go and look at input queues. You would see that messages are stacked on the input queues. You've got no open handles on the input queues. Then, sort of during the course of troubleshooting or trying to isolate the issue, suddenly things just take off and messages are being processed and things just go fine and you don't really understand what just happened there. And generally what we find has occurred was at some point prior, and it's usually due to another message that was received that made reference to the config delay timeout, customers would generally take this, which the default value is 60, and figure, well, if it's 60, we'll just give it more time and maybe make it 600 or something like that. So they've taken it from a minute up to 10 minutes. And the way this kind of works is when the broker is starting up, the admin agent initiates starting of all the execution groups, and it also starts a thread to monitor those processes as they start. Once it's done all that, it checks via those threads to determine which ones have started and issues a start message to go ahead and start the message flows. In a constrained system, especially a constrained system that's got a number of execution groups associated with the broker, it may be that none of the execution groups have fully started at the time that the start command was issued for the message flows. And so what happens is we wait for the amount of period of time associated with the config delay timeout, in this case it would be 10 minutes, and then issue another start command. And that would be about the time that you were in there checking handles on queues when suddenly everything started to run. So that would be, the config delay timeout would be a good candidate in a scenario like this. One thing you could do to determine if this was the issue would be to use your toolkit to explicitly send a start message to the execution group to see whether that made a difference or not. And if it did, then chances are you've somehow inadvertently or explicitly set the config delay timeout to be something higher than you should. You should probably set it back to 60 or around there. If 60 is too low, you should jump in small steps, 80 or 90, 100 maybe, but certainly not to 600 where you could see the behavior that I just mentioned. So let's go to the next foil, that'd be number 27, please. And this actually is a scenario that if you've been working with the message broker very long, I'm sure you've run into. It's the BIP 2066E, that the broker is unable to retrieve an internal configuration response. So you've gone ahead and made some configuration request to the broker, and you get, and basically the config manager didn't get back a response to that in the time period allowed. So the BIP 2066 occurs. You might discover that the deploy may or may not have been successful depending upon where the issue resides here. The first thing to do that I recommend to customers, especially when they're deploying to new brokers, is to deploy something that's fairly simple just to test out the MQ connectivity between the config manager and the broker. And then beyond that, you can go ahead and increase and begin to send some bigger flows. But oftentimes what we see are customers that are maybe moving from test to production, and they're taking these very highly configured execution groups and doing very large deploys. And we can actually then see a 2066 result from that. You can tune the configuration timeout and configuration delay timeout values, but you want to sort of do that with the previous error that I talked about in mind. And in our publications, in our documentation, we talk a little bit about how to go ahead and set those. Additionally, you would want to reduce the scope of the deploy and sort of send things in chunks
as opposed to one big deploy if you're seeing a 2066. Beyond that, if you've tried those things and you're still seeing it, or if you get to 2066 when you try to deploy the small flow, then what you'd want to do would probably be to either, you know, go and have a look at our tech notes to see the kinds of things that we published relative to 2066s. And if that doesn't get you where you need to be, then just go ahead and put a call on us, and we'll work with you directly on that issue. So I guess at this point I'm going to turn it back over to Prasad to cover the next item.
To continue the discussion about deploys, one of the reasons why you could see 2066, or you could see a slow turnaround on a deploy, as in like you issued a deploy and it took a few minutes. One of the reasons for that could be the size of your bar file itself, and it's very obvious, the bigger the size of your bar file, the more time the broker is going to take to process. So be aware about the size of your bar file that you're deploying, and if there's any way you could structure your bar files in such a way that you get better deploys or much more faster deploys, we'd certainly encourage you to do that, because it doesn't, I'm sure you don't want to sit there after issuing deploy waiting for response or wondering when it's going to respond back. And one of the reasons a bar file could be pretty big is if you are including external jar files within a bar file. And this goes to the usage of Java compute nodes, or generally referring external jar files for added functionality. If your developers are referring external jar files, the best practice should be that they should add the jar file as an external jar, not an internal, not an implicit jar. The difference there being, if it is added to as an implicit jar, then it gets packaged with the bar file, which could be looked at as a pretty good thing, because then you have your bar file as an independent deployable module entity that you can pass to other environments. But the problem with that is, again, the trade-off there is the size of the bar file. You want to keep an eye on that and follow the best practice recommendation of always add jar files with external jar files, in which case what's going to happen is the reference will get added to the bar file, and the jars themselves will not get packaged with the bar file, but just a reference will be there, and you can copy these external jars into the shared classes directory on the broker machine, and that way the broker will pick up these jar files and they'll be available, and by doing this, your bar file size will be pretty much reduced to just your compiled message flows and your message sets and nothing more than that, and you will actually reduce deploy errors by doing this, and also you can see much more faster turnaround on deploys. Let's move on to further deploy issues, and Randy is going to talk about a specific ZOS known problem in this area.
Okay. The next issue that I'm going to cover here is specific to ZOS, and it's when deploying from a non-ZOS config manager to a broker on ZOS. What you would see in a case like this would be a BIP 7150E on the configuration manager, and you would also notice probably that the deploy that you had done was successful. The error that actually gets reported is as a result of a topic subscription process that occurs after the deploy. As I said earlier, it is unique to the scenario with a ZOS broker getting deployed to by a non-ZOS config manager. APAR PK45860 addresses this issue, and it will not be shipped until FixPack 6. So if you see this issue, you can go ahead and contact us, and we could provide you a user mod in the interim. So next foil. The next foil actually talks about a BIP 15360. And this is somewhat similar to the previous one, except it's a bit more general or generic. This actually occurs, again, as a result of some type of a deployment. And then this is the actual flow that goes to the broker to register for subscription so that the broker will automatically report changes in runtime status back to the configuration manager. That then gets passed back to the toolkit. So if you were seeing a bit 1536, it's probably very likely then that the toolkit that you're looking at would not accurately reflect the status of the broker. The thing to check for would be that the broker or that the configuration manager service ID is actually defined and exists on the actual broker system. All right, that would be the first thing to check. And again, as I said earlier, there are other things that relate to this 1536E. Many of those are documented out on as tech notes. So suggestion first would be to go ahead and have a look out there to see if you can find your symptom. If not, you know, go ahead and give us a call of support. So at this point, I'll turn it back to Prasad. He's going to talk a little bit about the Config Manager proxy exercise.
Thanks, Randy. To pretty much continue the discussion about the IP 1536E, which doesn't necessarily mean that the deploy failed. It just means that the Config Manager cannot receive status messages because it was unable to subscribe to internal status subscriptions for the deploy that was recently performed. When you see a problem like this, version 6 of the broker actually shipped a sample called a Config Manager Proxy Exerciser. It's an excellent sample that can run not only on Windows, but also on Unixes. If you have X Windows, you can run this exerciser on a Unix machine as well. Gives you an excellent administrative view of your broker domain and provides certain functionalities that the toolkit doesn't provide. For example, the proxy exerciser can be used to register for internal subscriptions on the broker. It's pretty simple. You connect to the broker domain by providing the config manager details, and you go to your broker, right-click, and you see an option there about registering internal subscriptions. And so it's one way to overcome 1536 kind of an exception if you're suspecting that that the information your toolkit is not showing, the information that the toolkit is showing is incorrect for some reason, or if it is stale. Config Manager Proxy Exerciser is one way that you could go back in there and re-register for internal subscriptions. And as such, the Proxy Exerciser is an excellent sample that I strongly recommend you to use it and get a good view of your broker domain in the functionality it provides. And it's mainly used it's a sample to show the Config Manager Proxy API. However, it can be used to get a good picture of your broker runtime as well. Moving on to further deploy issues, there is an environment variable. While generally the broker logs, that is the application log on Windows and syslog on Unixes and the job log on ZOS, they're pretty good logs, and the broker does externalize all the messages, informational errors, warnings. However, it doesn't provide any specifics about deploy activity and for example, tracking a deploy or trying to find out where your deploy is currently. It doesn't provide that level of detailed messaging, but it is possible for you to get that level of detailed messaging using an environment variable. It's optional. It's used by us mostly to troubleshoot deploy problems, but it doesn't hurt if you are an administrator or if you are an environment, if you're an environment where deploys are being a common issue that you're seeing. It will definitely recommend you to set this environment variable. It's called MQSI_show_deploy. And I believe on ZOS, it is actually set, yes, Randy?
Yep.
On ZOS, it is set in the EMV file by default.
Right.
It's called MQSI_progress. Both of these pretty much provide you with the same functionality and helps in isolating or helps in answering questions like where exactly is my deploy right now, what is it waiting on. And the information you get is actually shown in the next file. The information you get when you set this environment variable and restart your broker is very clear specifics in terms of what time the deploy message was received, what time it was sent to the execution group, and what time the response was sent. So it's a level of detail that you wouldn't get otherwise. And by setting this environment variable, you will get exact specifics. The message ID that you want to track is BIP8099I. It's information message. Yes, it will include an excessive logging to your syslog. However, it's not that huge overhead in terms of logging. It's important that you restart the broker to pick up this change, as is with any other environment variables. You want to restart your broker so it picks up this change and enables this additional logging. That kind of pretty much brings us towards the end here. We're trying to stay within the time we've been assigned, which is an hour, and looks like we've ran by 30 seconds or so here. We talked about broker in a nutshell, just so for those of you who are starting new with the broker, we figured we'd give you a quick introduction about the components. And we talked about common problems in three specific areas. Broker provides an extensive, the functionality the broker provides is pretty extensive, so we have to pick and choose and be careful in terms of what we include or what we do not include, just because we want to address the broker community, and we realize there are some of you who are at 6.5, some of you who are running ZOS, some of you who are running Windows, or older 6.5s, and so we wanted to get that balance, and hopefully we've done that here. We've included a few APARs towards the end, mainly from an awareness point of view. Again, most of those APARs have, or they will have iFixes, so if you think that there is an APAR in here that's of interest to you, please do give us a call, and we'll try to do our best to get you an iFix. Now, one of the files towards the end also talks about opening up a PMR, and I'll let Randy talk a little bit about it, just because we find it always helps when we get the right information every time you open a PMR. That'll expedite and allow us to give a quick turnaround on your problems.
Okay, very quickly, the more information that we get sort of out of the gate, the more that that we can do with it, and the less interactions that we have to do as far as come back to us for sort of base documentation. This is very self-explanatory, so I won't actually go through the details. And as well, there's a must-gather website down here that has much of the same information as well. So before you open a PMR, if you would go to these locations, have a look at what we request. If you spend just a little extra time up front, it will actually assist us and to assist you better, actually. So, and that's actually that was on page 35. Okay, so with that, we've got some additional bookmarks in the back for your reference you can have a look at. Nothing I don't think that we want to go through with you right now. And at this point, I'd like to go ahead and just turn this back over for question and answers.
We do have a question from Shirley Fraser from the state of Texas.
I just wanted to confirm on the very last environment variable we talked about, the MQSI show deploy, that has low enough overhead that we could leave that variable set all the time unless we're doing enormous amounts of deployments?
Hi, Shirley. This is Prasant here. Thank you for your question. And
Yes, you can set this environment variable MQSI underscore show underscore deploy and leave it in the environment. Every time a deploy occurs, it generates about four messages.
Mm-hmm.
All these messages are the BIP8099i informational messages,
mm-hmm.
and it does have very low overhead in your environment, in any broker environment for the matter. So if you have a broker environment where you're you're developing actively and you have a lot of deploys going through, and if you'd like to track your deploys, I definitely recommend you leave this environment variable set so you can quickly go into the log and check in case you have a need to track your deploys.
And, Prasad, does that write to the user.log where I have all the rest of my messages being directed at this point?
Yes, surely, correct.
Okay, and I noticed one more question, and then I'll give somebody else the floor. I noticed on the slide that you printed out, the excerpt from user.log, it looked like you had accomplished leaving a blank line between each entry. Did you?
Yes, I edited. I took this snippet from a Unix syslog, and my favorite editor on Unix is VI, and when you look at the VI, it's pretty compressed.
I thought maybe you had found a way to make it print like that. Okay, thank you.
No, I wanted to present the information so it's not cluttered, and so I spaced it myself.
Yeah, usually if I'm troubleshooting, I do the same thing. I'll put it into an editor and space
right.
them out. I thought maybe you'd found a way to make a print like that.
Definitely let you know if I find a way to space them out, yeah.
Okay, thank you so very much.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you. Once again, that's star one if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. Once again, please press star one. And we do have another question from Michael Wallace from Hennepin County.
Yes, this is my question, and it concerns FOIL 16. You said that problem with the bar service log growing in size with every refresh was fixed in Fix Pack 5. Is that iFix 5 for the toolkit or Fix Pack 5 for the broker? And if it's for the broker, so I was a little confused. We just put on Fix Pack 5 with the broker, and broker Fix Packs don't have anything to do with the toolkit, do they?
Yeah, you're correct, Mike. Thank you for pointing out the oversight on my part. What I meant there was iFix 5 for the toolkit.
Okay.
And it is, that's the latest fix pack where this problem was addressed.
All right. So if we have the latest fix pack on our toolkits, which is iFix 9, we won't have a problem with that.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah, I will go back and check on this. I thank you for actually pointing this out to me. I will go back and confirm this and let you know. I do have your contact details, and I'll confirm this back to you.
I have another question.
Sure.
And I've run into this problem before and had another PMR open. But I just deployed, or I just installed FixPack IA07 in my 6.0.2.0 iFix9 toolkit. And, you know, I got a warning that there were some conflicts. And I went ahead anyway, and now I get another error bringing up my toolkit. And I had previously opened a PMR on this that took a long time to resolve. Have you had any other reports of problems installing that fix pack into the version 6 toolkit?
I'm afraid I will have to say I don't know.
Okay, well, I'll
that could be a very bad answer, but off the top, I'm not aware. Actually, I do keep track of some of the pervasive or commonly reported problems, and I don't recall seeing issues installing toolkit fix packs. You did say you opened up a PMR
earlier. Well, I had this problem almost a year ago when I had an earlier version of the toolkit, and I ended up, before it was over, uninstalling and reinstalling the toolkit. I don't want to go through that again, but I think what I'll do is open another PMR, because I even get a warning message if I go into the product configuration window and try to uninstall FixPack 7.
Right. I definitely recommend you call in and open up a PMR so we can look at the specifics. We do keep track of commonly known problems or known issues. Again, there are multiple reasons we do this. One is to generally put awareness for the team, awareness point of view, and second is so we can publish a tech note if the problem is so widely perceived or widely experienced. So, and I don't recall that we've seen any similar issues with installing FixPack. So, go ahead and open up a PMR, and we'll take a look at the specifics, and we'll work with you. And
This isn't a FixPack. This is one of your support packs.
You said IA07, correct?
Yeah, that's a support pack.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's not a FixPack.
Do you know which support pack is this?
That's the SendMail plugin.
Okay. Mike, what would be good is go ahead and open up a PMR, and we'll get some specifics from you. We do have quite a number of users using the SendMail plugin, and I haven't heard of any known issues in this area.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, that is *1 if you'd like to ask a question. And there are no further questions at this time.
At this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the West Area Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Randy Prasad, for presenting today.
Thank you, Roger. Thanks.